morning. We are beginning our March oral arguments, and our first case is 99-2803, State v. TJ International, Inc., arguing for the State of Wisconsin Assistant Attorney General Jerry L. Hancock. Mr. Hancock?
May it please the Court, my name is Jerry Hancock. I'm an Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin. When the legislature enacted the Wisconsin Business Closing Law, it anticipated a set of circumstances very much like those that developed in the village of Hawkins in June of 1996. And the statute establishes a process for balancing the interests of the employer in the interest of the employee when a business is sold. Unfortunately, in this case, that process was not followed. Beginning in December of 1995, TJ International, a large lumber company, wood products company based in Boise, Idaho, and the parent company of Norco Windows based in Hawkins, Wisconsin, began negotiations to sell the Hawkins facility. Those negotiations continued until July 1st of 1996, when the facility was sold to Jeldwin. Jeldwin is another large wood product company based in Klamath Falls, Oregon. In April of 1996, TJ International sent a letter to all Norco employees indicating that they were in negotiations to sell the plant and clearly indicating their intention to exit the window business. On June 7, 1996, all the Norco employees received two letters, one from Norco TJ and the other from Jeldwin. The letter from Norco TJ informed them that as of the date of the sale, they would no longer be employees of Norco. All 459 employees received that letter. The same day, they received another letter from Jeldwin saying that they were going to restructure the plant, they didn't know which positions would be filled, and they didn't know who would be hired to fill them. And the Norco employees were offered only the opportunity to apply, and their applications would be considered with all others received.
Well, were they kept in the plant working while all of these applications were received and they were, I suppose, interviewed or whatever they were?
The employment continued until July 1st of 1996. That was the date of termination.
Did the plant ever stop producing the products?
No, Your Honor. The plant continued in operation.
And were at least 75% of employees there at all times?
I would presume so, Your Honor. I don't know what the shifts were and
well,
how,
I mean,
how they were.
Well, I mean, totality. And the reason I picked 75% is because of the statute.
The statute, 75% is the standard for mass layoff, Your Honor. We have always argued that this is not a mass layoff case. This is a business closing case.
And why do you argue that? Because you always have the 75% being rehired?
No, Your Honor, not at all. We believe the 75% is irrelevant.
Okay.
This case turns on 10907-1B, which is the definition of business closing. And if you read that statute carefully, you'll see that it's worded in the disjunctive. A business closing is defined as the permanent or temporary shutdown of an employment site or facility that affects more than 25 employees. In this case, Your Honor, it's a stipulated fact that all 459 employees of the Norco plant were terminated.
They were, counsel, they were terminated, and then they were sent the letter, and then they had to physically reapply. Any person that wanted a job, as I understand it, had to put their name on the dotted line and reapply.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the letter further stated that those applications would be given no preferential treatment.
And that's what you base part of the argument on, that there was a shutdown, because if hypothetically no one had sent the letter, as the company indicated, you wouldn't have a job. You had to do some act.
That's correct, Your Honor. So, again, the statute is worded, business closing definition is in the disjunctive. So it's the closing of an employment site or facility. It's stipulated that the facility continued in operation, but Norco, by laying off all the employees, there were no more paychecks from Norco, clearly closed the employment site. And that was their intention all along.
Yeah, but that, isn't that a little technical? I mean, sure, the Norco was out because it had sold the business, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So it's going to say, hey, I don't owe you any wages anymore, buddies. You're not my employees, right?
Well, Your Honor, correct.
Right. So what you do is have on the one hand that letter saying, you are fired. I'm gone. I'm out of here.
Right.
And he got another letter at the same time saying, yeah, but we take Norco's place, in effect.
Your Honor, if that had been the letter, and if there had been compliance with the statute, this would be a very different case. That was not the letter, and that was not the reality. No one that worked for Norco was guaranteed or promised or even reassured that they would have a job with Gelbin. Gelbin clearly intended to restructure the facility, and nobody was guaranteed a job.
Well, I don't want to be simple-minded, but it's, if you look at that definition, it says that that the facility or site, right?
It's an employment site or facility.
Employment site or facility is permanently or temporarily shut down. So how does the fact that you've got one company selling off and saying, I'm out of here, and another company picking everybody up so that there's not a moment's stoppage of production, right? How does that constitute a permanent or temporary shutdown of a site or facility?
Well,
or operating unit?
There are two answers to that, Your Honor.
Okay.
First of all, on the facts, and I can't emphasize this enough, not everybody was picked up by Gelbin.
Right.
And Gelbin never intended to pick everybody up.
Right. They just said they would do what make reasonable efforts. Or whatever
they would make
that
effect. Correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, is that true even if they sent this letter and said, I want to be employed, that the company still made a decision and did not employ some? I know there were 110 people that were not employed, but many of them didn't send the letter, et cetera, et cetera. But if someone sent the letter, weren't they automatically employed?
No, Your Honor. There were approximately 40.
They were not automatically employed.
Right. I'd like to return to the purpose, the statutory purpose of the business closing law, which is to provide notice to the employees. By not providing the notice and waiting until the day of the sale to complete the employment, they were putting the workers in a take-it-or-leave-it situation. The union employees were forced to take an average 15% cut in pay. They lost their seniority and receive fewer benefits. So this was never the benign transfer of employees from one company to the other. It was not the situation where you went to work on Friday for Norco and showed up on Monday working for Gelbin. Those are not the facts of this case. And I think, returning to your question, Chief Justice, about the wording of the business closing law, it is in the disjunctive. Closing of an employment site or facility. The legislature obviously contemplated a situation exactly like this one, where you could have the closing of an employment site, that an employer left the business, shut down, no longer employed people, no longer gave them paychecks, but for some reason the physical operation could continue. You can envision a circumstance where they might have changed the whole operation and employed only 10 people to run the facility. And clearly, that would not alleviate the requirement of notice.
Mr. Hancock, did the union representation of the employees continue?
Your Honor, the union representation continued under a labor standard that says that if 50% plus one of the employees are unionized, the union continues to be represent the employees. They were required to bargain again for a new contract with Jelly.
But the same union continued to represent the employees of the new operator.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, I'd like to emphasize a point that was made in the amicus brief filed by the union, which is that by failing to give the 60-day notice and by putting the employees in basically a take-it-or-leave-it situation, the union lost an enormous amount of leverage, and the employer was able to set the wages and conditions of employment for the workers that were hired by Jelly.
Counsel?
I'm sorry, Justin.
That's okay. I want to digress a bit because I'm bothered by the standard of review and procedural posture of this case and how the two interrelate. This is, as I recall, there was an initial determination by the DWD and then a final determination by the department, DWD. And the final determination found that there was a violation of the notice provision for business closing, right?
Correct.
Was that, and issued an order, was that finding an order ever appealed from?
No, Your Honor, because, if I may explain, this is not what would be typically a 227 kind of review. Under 10907, the statute, the process that's envisioned is that there will be a complaint made to DWD. DWD will investigate. They will make a determination whether or not notice was given. If notice was not given, they determine the amount of the penalty. And then if the penalty is not paid, there's a referral to DOJ for enforcement. So there's never any envision of a 227 review process.
Well, you say enforcement, and I guess that's what I'm getting at. Are there any issues of res judicata or collateral estoppel claim or issue preclusion here? I mean, because the underlying determination on the merits doesn't appear to be appealed from. You're the one that's initiating the original action for enforcement of the underlying conclusion.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, I believe that's a statutory procedure. All parties have stipulated that this is a de novo review and that there is no deference owed to the DWD decision.
And what legal authority is there for that?
For the no deference?
Yeah, because if this were an appeal from DWD, there would probably be great weight deference, and you would certainly have a different court of appeals opinion than you have. You may have a different court of appeals opinion than you have.
one could only hope. Justice Bradley.
So what legal authority is there for the standard of review? I'm sure there is some, but I just don't know it.
Again, I would point to the fact that this is an original action, not a review. But if this were a 227 kind of case, I would argue that the DWD decision is due no deference because it is inconsistent with the statute and not supported by the facts. And under traditional 227 review criteria, an opinion that fails on both of those counts is due no deference by the reviewing court. In this instance, DWD found that the companies were entitled to the notice exception that is provided in 10907-4A, which is if the purchaser agrees in writing to hire substantially all the seller's employees, then notice is not required. DWD found as a fact that had occurred. Clearly, that did not occur. The record is clear, is a stipulated fact, that Geldman only promised to make all reasonable efforts to hire all affected employees. That is clearly inadequate as a matter of law. It's clearly inaccurate as a matter of fact. They did not guarantee in writing to hire substantially all. So therefore, I would argue that the DWD decision is due no deference. I would come back to the fact that the companies also agree that the DWD decision is due no deference. And I would urge the court not to adopt the DWD analysis of this case, because I think by their reliance on the fact that the companies complied with the exception is an error.
Could I ask a question? Why is Geldwin an employer here?
Your Honor, Geldwin was the purchaser of the facility, and Geldwin eventually hired 349 of the 459 former Norco employees. Under the administrative rule, DWD 279, when a business is sold, the obligation for notice transfers from the seller to the buyer on the day of sale. If the employees are terminated on the day of sale...
Where do you get the authority for that administrative rule?
The authority, DWD had the authority under the statute to adopt administrative rules. And they adopted this rule as a way of apportioning the responsibility for notice when the terminations occur on the day of sale. It's DWD 279-02, which establishes the process for apportioning the notice responsibility. And the penalties flow with the responsibility.
Now, that's the rule, but why can you push this notice obligation to the buyer?
There are two reasons, Your Honor, for pushing the notice obligation in this case to the buyer. First of all, the buyer did not agree in writing to hire substantially all the Norco employees. Secondly, they did not in fact hire substantially all the Norco employees. The standard in this case is not the 75%, but 25. Under the business closing law, if more than 25 employees are affected, then notice is required. So Norco did not hire, Geldman did not hire, did not meet the standard, did not make the promise, did not keep the promise. So it's appropriate to apportion the responsibility between TJ Norco and Geldman.
There's nothing in the statute that requires a business purchaser to make that promise, though, is there?
Your Honor, it... Yes, there is, frankly. The exception, I think, proves the rule. The process envisioned by the statute is that notice is required when a business is sold, unless you qualify for the exception, which requires the seller to agree to hire substantially all.
But that doesn't impose an affirmative obligation on the buyer of a business to hire all of the employees. They're free to contract to do that or not, as they will. The statute doesn't impose that requirement. It says if the notice requirement is, if the seller's obligation to give notice is going to be relieved, there has to be that clause in the contract, but it doesn't require it to be there.
That's correct, Your Honor. But
so how is it that your administrative rule is consistent at all with the statute? And this goes back to Justice Prosser's question about where is the authority for the agency to promulgate such an administrative rule that conflicts with the statute?
Your Honor, I would simply cite to the statute that allows them to develop rules. This is also consistent with the process that the Federal Department of Labor uses in Warren Act cases. And so I think that they have the authority. They promulgated the rule. The rule was promulgated, I believe, in 1994.
It went through the legislative process?
That, Your Honor, I don't know. I assume that, it's adopted as an administrative rule.
Where's the provision about rulemaking for the department?
Your Honor, I don't know that.
Okay, you can.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. We can find it. So your argument is, if I understand it, that an employer who sells the assets, is that what the sale was here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, sells the assets and has at-will employees, in effect, and fires them all, that that employer has to give notice under 109.07. And that that is a business closing as a permanent or temporary shutdown of a facility. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It is a business closing because it is a temporary or permanent shutdown of an employment site.
Okay. All right. Of an employment site. And it's a temporary or permanent shutdown of an employment site because this company, Norco, is no longer an employer.
Correct.
All right. And although that doesn't seem intuitively correct, when you go out of business but that the company is still operating or that the production line is still on, I suppose you're bolstered by 109.076 that says the sale of part or all of the employer's business is covered there as to when you don't have to give notice. So that would indicate that when you sell your business, that is a business closing under B. That's your argument in a nutshell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. But the Court of Appeals says you don't get to 6A if you don't meet the threshold definition of business closing in 109.071B, right? That's
correct,
where you part company with the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the Court of Appeals did not seriously consider the disjunctive wording of the business closing law, which is closing of an employment site or facility. And the
or facility at an employment site. Right? If you read the whole sentence. Which makes an interpretive difference, don't you think? Business closing means a permanent or temporary shutdown of an employment site or of one or more facilities or operating units at an employment site. So a reasonable construction of that would be that it means a permanent or temporary shutdown of an entire employment site or part of an employment site, if it meets the definition of facility or operating unit.
That would be one interpretation, Your Honor. I believe that that phrase in the statute relates to one or more operating units, but I would simply say the state's position is the statutory procedure is clear on its face that notice is required. If there is any necessity to resort to canons of statutory interpretation or anything else, we would argue that this is a remedial statute and is entitled to liberal interpretation to affect the intention of the legislature, which was clearly to provide notice to employees when there's going to be a significant change in their employment circumstances. And the facts in this case, I think, are clearly a significant change in the lives of the employees in Hawkins.
Mr. Hancock, when you have an opportunity, I think the section is 109.12 about rules that the administration can promulgate. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hancock.
Justice Prosser.
When did Genwell close the business?
Jeltman never closed the business, Your Honor. Jeltman was the purchaser. Norco, T.J. Norco was the seller, and Jeltman was the purchaser.
Okay. The buyer, isn't the buyer required under the statute either to have a permanent or temporary shutdown?
Your Honor, I believe the language in the definition of business closing would apply to the closure of an employment site. And in this case, it was the seller that closed the employment site.
If the seller closed the employment site, how could the buyer close the employment site?
We do not argue that the buyer closed the employment site, Your Honor.
Well, then how is the buyer involved here?
The buyer, I'm sorry, my time is up, Your Honor. May I?
You may answer the question, Mr. Hancock.
The buyer is responsible because of their refusal to agree to hire substantially all the employees and because they didn't follow through.
And that falls under the rule 27902.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I don't see how that rule, I mean, I can see an agency wanting that rule, but I don't see how that rule in 279.022 tracks the statute.
If you focus on the fact that the responsibility only shifts if the terminations occur on the date of sale, then I think it may be a little clearer. If the terminations occur on the day of sale, then there has to be some apportioning of the notice responsibility. And that's what the rule attempts to do.
But it is a statute, an administrative action which goes beyond what the statute requires, doesn't it? I mean, there's nothing in the statute that would be consistent with that rule.
Well, except, Your Honor, I believe that the exception is actually a two-pronged test. The exception is that the purchaser must agree in writing to hire substantially all.
It doesn't say that. It says if the employer wants to get out from the notice requirements, then the purchase agreement has to contain that promise or that agreement. It doesn't require in all situations that promise be made.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, my time is up, but if I may complete my answer.
You may.
If this court were to determine that the administrative rule is inconsistent with the statute and that Jeldwin bears no responsibility for the notice in this case, and that Norco bears all the responsibility because clearly somebody was responsible for providing that notice to the affected employees. If the court wants to determine that falls entirely on Norco, that's an appropriate result in this case. I think the rule is clear and appropriate, but if the court finds that it's not supported by the statute, then Norco bears the full responsibility.
Thank you, counsel.
Chief, may I ask one
question?
Yes,
Justice Prosser.
If memory serves me correctly, 63 people never applied to the buyer for to be rehired. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Is that relevant?
The companies have argued that that's relevant. The state does not believe it's relevant because the purpose of the statute is to give employees notice so that the employees and their families and the community can determine what their options are. And one option is obviously not to continue to work for the company. And by failing to give notice, it was that option that was lost. So there's no requirement that they apply for the jobs. The law requires notice so that employees have options.
There's one other question by Justice Bablich.
I wasn't going to ask it, but now you've opened it up. How can you say that Norco Windows, that it's okay, that it's an appropriate result that Norco Windows be held liable for the whole boodle? They're not even here.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. TJ International, who is the parent company of Norco Windows, would bear the full responsibility.
So is it... Well, then maybe TJ International is an adverse party to Gelwood.
I think, Your Honor, that's an appropriate question for opposing counsel.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hancock. You agree at one thing. Either one or both of you should win. Okay. Now, according to my notes, Mr. Lynch of Foley and Lardner, representing Geldwin, has 15 minutes, and Mr. Duffy of Quarles and Brady, representing TJ International, has 15 minutes. Okay?
That's correct.
Counsel, you may proceed.
My name is Lawrence Lynch. I represent the buyer in this case, Geldwin. Section 109.071B is the interpretation that's at issue here today. Defines a business closing as a permanent or temporary shutdown of an employment site that affects 25 or more employees. The state interprets an employment site as an employer going out of business, NARCO, TJ International. We interpret an employment site as being a location where people work. The state's interpretation wants 109.071B to read either that a business closing occurs in an asset sale which results in the buyer not hiring 25 or more of the seller's employees, irrespective of what happens to the employment site, or that every employee who changes employers in an asset sale is an affected employee as defined in the statute.
Now let's see if I understand your position. Your position would be that here NARCO sells out to Geldwin, that Norco so advises them and says, everybody, we're no longer your employee, your employment relationship has ended as of whatever day. Geldwin then has 300 employees that it brings in from Illinois. It has made arrangements. These people are ready to come and go. They put out housing for them, et cetera. And so on the following day, the plant continues in business with 300 Illinois employees, and all 300 Wisconsin employees are out. Now, is it your position that there's been no closing under the statute?
That situation would be a mass layoff, Your Honor. Because the operation continues, more than 25% of the seller's employees do not continue with the buyer. The state is taking the position that you only look at this as being a business closing, or plant closing as you use
the term. But doesn't the definition of mass closing, mass closing says a reduction in an employer's workforce that is not the result of a business closing. The chief's example seems to take it right out of that definition.
This is not a business closing because the employment site continued.
Under your definition, this is perfectly all right. It's not a closing because the employment site has not been temporarily or permanently shut down.
That's right. That's an extreme example, Your Honor.
Well, but that's the whole point, to test your...
As is the state's position, is an extreme position. The state's position basically means that Geldwin, my client, who hired over 76% of the workers of Norco, owes 60 days back pay and benefits to the employees that had hired 359 employees. Almost all of them didn't miss a single day of employment. They were Norco employees up until July 1, and then became Geldwin employees. Now under the state's interpretation and under the DWD's interpretation, as of July 1, Geldwin now owes its own employees 60 days pay and benefits.
But if they hadn't sent the letter, opposing counsel is correct, this letter went out and it obligated each employee to respond. Some employees didn't, but and some employees, as I understand, that did respond were not hired. And that's my question. So if there was a break, there was a decision to be made, at least by the company sent out this notice, this letter. And what about that momentary decision that had to be made? Either you're coming back, you may come back under different circumstances were that there was a 15% reduction in wages, but you had to make the application. That seems to be the state's position.
And that is the normal thing that happens in an asset sale, Your Honor. Happens every day across the country and throughout Wisconsin. Federal labor law gives a buyer the right to set the initial terms and conditions of employment. Mr. Hancock's right about the successorship issue in terms of the union, and Geldwin succeeded to the union obligation and negotiated a new contract with the union, but it had the right to set the initial terms and conditions. We do not know why that those 47 or so employees who did not apply for jobs who did apply for jobs with Geldwin weren't hired. That's not in the record. Nor do we know why the 63 other employees who had the opportunity to apply for jobs with Geldwin didn't even do that. They didn't complete the process. The state's position is that a buyer doesn't have the right to change the terms and conditions of employment in this kind of situation, which is just wrong. The statute talks about an employment loss only. You become an effective employee if you suffer an employment loss.
Counsel, yes, you preface a number of your comments with the state's position. Is this a mass layoff?
This almost was a mass layoff, Your Honor.
Okay.
It missed it by 1%, 2%.
Well, I suppose in one interpretation of the facts, it seems to me that maybe it is, and one interpretation of the facts that everyone was terminated.
That's the state's position.
Okay. If the facts indicate that everyone was, that the employees received a letter and the letter indicated that they are terminated and that the new employer may or may not rehire them, and the decision of the new employer with regard to rehire is permanent. You don't rehire. If the facts indicate that all of them were terminated, is this a mass layoff?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because Geldwin agreed to make reasonable efforts to hire substantially all of the Norco employees, and the statute redresses business closing and mass layoffs. Notice can be required under either circumstance. When the employment site continues on, it can't be a plant closing. A business closing. It could be a mass layoff.
Okay, walk me through, if you will, the definition of it. Seems to comport initially with the definition of mass layoff in 10972A, maybe. No.
I think it's 1F.
Anyway, under 10907, how's that?
Okay.
It appears initially
to fulfill the definition. Mass layoff means a reduction in an employer's workforce that is not the result of a business closing. Well, this isn't the result of a business closing. And that affects the following numbers of employees at an employment site or within, etc. Number one, at least 25% of the employer's workforce or 25 employees, whichever or greater. You've got that by any definition of the facts, don't you? In other words, if one definition of the facts or one interpretation of the facts is they all lost their jobs subject to the benevolence of rehire, they're affected. Or then you have, of course, that core that were not rehired that's greater than 25. So tell me why this isn't a mass layoff. I know the state didn't pursue it as a mass layoff. But why isn't this a mass layoff?
Because the the parties in the purchase agreement, as an amendment to the purchase agreement on July 1 of 1996, agreed that the buyer, Geldwin, would hire substantially all, or make reasonable efforts to hire substantially all, of the seller's workforce.
But that's not what the statute requires. The statute requires you to hire, not make reasonable efforts, but to hire.
And as a practical matter, Your Honor, you cannot make somebody work for you. You can offer employment to somebody, you make efforts to hire somebody, but you cannot force somebody to work for you. As a reality, you make efforts to hire people, you offer them employment within your rights under the law, setting the terms and conditions, and if they decide to work for you, fine. 47 well, or 63 in this situation didn't.
If your letter had said that we will offer employment to all, then I can understand your argument. But you didn't say that in that letter. You said all reasonable efforts. It's a very different thing, I think.
We think it means the same thing. No.
Well, but it means the difference of I now have to apply to you. And I run the risk of getting it or not getting it. It's different than if you write me and say, you're automatically on, and if you don't want to come with us, we might understand it, but you ought to give us a chance with your employment. And that's just, those are two very different things.
If this was a stock sale, the employer would stay the same. Continue on. Right. You wouldn't change. The employee would not notice a difference in the employer. The owner of the stock would change. This situation, the employer has to change. Norco is leaving. It's moving out of Hawkins. It's selling its assets to Geldwin. The employees have a choice whether they're going to continue on. We cannot guarantee that they're going to be working for us, and they're not going to guarantee they're going to be working for us. It's a bilateral contract that they enter into, even if it's an at-will contract.
If this had been a stock change, then there would be no permanent or temporary shutdown. Or if it was, it would be by the corporation, there'd only be one. And you couldn't do a reduction in the workforce unless you complied with a lot of other things.
If this was a stock deal, Norco, TJ, and Geldwin would be the same company,
right,
for all practical purposes.
And you wouldn't come under 10907.
Right. If instead of coming back to work on Monday, they closed the plant for one day, would that then qualify this as a business closing?
No, it wouldn't, because the statute describes an employment loss as actually being terminated or suffering a break in employment of more than 6 months.
Okay.
So there's really a six-month window. The statute was meant to track, in a lot of ways, the Warren Act. The state made a lower threshold number as far as what a business closing is in comparison to what a plant closing is under the Warren Act, and reached also a lower threshold number for a mass layoff versus the two laws.
Also,
but it's the same concept under both.
You say, I'm trying to understand the argument here, and maybe you've got more to argue. You say it's not a business closing because there was not, well, for the reasons that you've stated. And you say it's not a mass closing, and the reason that you say it's not a mass closing is because of this letter that says they're going to make reasonable efforts.
And in fact, it's not a mass layoff because Geldwin, the real reason, because Geldwin hired 76% of the TJ Norco employees.
So
we didn't get to that 20.
You got 2 hours in your
credit. We didn't get to that 25% of the workforce that was not hired.
Within the 6 months.
Right.
Within the 60 days or six months.
It's 6 months actually for the break in the plan.
what import, if any, are the alleged facts that the rehire was at 15% less salary, cut of benefits, and no seniority?
None whatsoever. It's not an employment loss. And as Mr. Hancock clarified, I noted in the Supreme Court's announcement of describing the case, that cut actually only applied to the offer that was made to the unionized employees, not the other employees. But irrespective, it doesn't make any difference. It's not an employment loss by offering a different term.
Let me make the facts tortuous. That is, that the new employer said, we'll rehire you all, but at 60% of your wages, no seniority, no health insurance, and no more pension benefits. So people in Hawkins, Wisconsin, that's it. You don't like it? Well, any relevance if those were the facts?
Absolutely. If you look to the Seventh Circuit's decision in the Unoval, whatever it's called, because you do look to federal law under the statute to see what happens under the Warren Act. And if the buyer comes in and offers terms that are so onerous, so terrible, that a reasonable person wouldn't accept those terms, that could be a constructive discharge. That's what the Seventh Circuit was indicating in dicta only. In that situation, I think that would, somebody says, I'm not going to work for Gelbwin because you've destroyed my livelihood and I just can't afford to work for you. I think that would be an employment loss under a constructive discharge theory.
Right, but that goes to the interpretation of the statutory term in the federal law of what constitutes a termination, right? Or under our statute, what an employment loss is, not what the meaning of the definition of business closing is.
Right.
Or even mass layoff, right?
Right, Your Honor. I think we're on a bit of a tangent on that one.
What do you think about this administrative rule that was the subject of some discussion?
Well, it's the purpose when the legislature revised 109.07 after the Warren Act to make it more consistent with the Warren Act. This was one of the areas which isn't consistent at all, and I think I don't know if it was inartfully drafted or what, but under the Warren Act, the seller is responsible for giving notice through the closing date if there is a plant closing or mass layoff. DWD or Diller at the time, when they drafted this rule, says that it's the seller's responsibility up to the date of the closing, and then it becomes the buyer's responsibility as of the date of the closing, which is a significant difference. And obviously, it doesn't make a lot of sense, particularly in this situation, where the 400 and or 343 people that we hire as of July 1 are people that we now owe notice to. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
So you agree it goes beyond what the statutory requirements are in terms of imposing liability on a successor?
I don't see any basis in the statute for that.
Well, 109.12 says it promulgates. To the extent that you say that the buyer is liable after the date of sale, you put the onus on both the buyer and seller to make sure that notice has been given. And obviously, the buyer and seller here had these notice statutes in mind and were fully aware of the law, whether it be federal or state. And so the point of aiding the administration is to put them both on notice, get them both to work to do this, so that you've got the onus on both of them in order to properly administer this, administer and enforce the law.
My time's up. Can I respond to that?
Sure.
Okay. The parties obviously were aware of what was going on here. That's why, you know, that Gelbwin ended up hiring 26% of Norco's employees. That wasn't coincidental, obviously.
Right. Just made it.
It just made it. And those are the numbers the legislature established. Because of that, you know, really, this case should not be here. This was not a business closing. We believe that the circuit court's opinion should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Duffy, representing JT International in Norcom. Before you proceed, I've been trying to get, remember to ask somebody. We had to have our places here a chart relating to various cases from the 7th, 10th Circuit, federal, and this case as to. So who presented that?
That's
Mr. Hancock? Okay.
I didn't heard that.
Okay. Do you each have copies of this chart?
Yes.
Two of you? Okay, thank you.
I didn't bring it to me with the podium.
Pardon me?
But I didn't bring it to the podium, but I'm sure.
No, I'm not
Mr.
going to ask
Hancock
any
would
questions.
Share it with
I
me.
Just want to know whether or not you've seen it and
yes.
have any objection to it. Or.
May it please the court, I'm Bob Duffy. I represent the seller in this case, TJ International and Norco Windows. And Amy Poprock and I are pleased to be here today to represent the seller. We're actually proud of the fact that in Hawkins, Wisconsin, Norco Windows continue to be manufactured by substantially the same people that manufactured those windows before July 1, 1996 and up till today. And we're also hopeful, in fact confident in light of the relationship that we established with Gerald Wen, the buyer, that with the good efforts of everyone, that Norco Windows will continue to be manufactured in Hawkins. And so we're proud of that. And I think that ultimately, when the court looks to what is the issue, it has to look to, was this a business closing under the statute? You've asked questions about whether it's an employment site, whether it's disjunctive or not. I think that going back to the definition itself is the easiest way to resolve the situation. It says a business closing means a permanent or temporary shutdown of an employment site. And to follow up with what Justice Sykes said, I think it has to be an employment site because it's where one or more facilities or operating units within an employment site. If you look to the standard definition of employment site under Webster, it talks about a permanent or temporary shutdown. If you look to the definition of what site means under Webster's talks about a physical location, a spatial location of an actual or planned structure, a space of ground occupied or to be occupied by a building. The parties have stipulated here effectively that there was no cessation of that business. Norco Windows continue to be manufactured at that site and haven't stopped for any relevant time period.
As of a particular date, did all these employees, were they your employees?
They were our employees up and through July 1 of 1996.
In July 2, 1996, did you have any employees at this business site, this employment site?
At the Hawkins facility?
Yeah.
No, Your Honor. As of July 1, they were not our employees.
So as of July 1, there was, in fact, there was no, you had no employment site, did you?
After July 1, that's correct.
So why isn't that and it was permanent, not temporary. You're not going to have one. You haven't had one since then, right? So why isn't that a permanent shutdown of the employment site of your company at this site?
I go back again, Your Honor, to the definition of site and what an employment site is.
Right, right. It's a physical location.
The physical location.
Okay. But employment has to mean something, right? Right?
Certainly.
Did you have any employees at this site on July 2, 1996?
No, we did not.
Was that a permanent shutdown of your employment site? That is, a site that you had employees on July 2?
Your Honor, I would say no because of what happened on July 1.
On July 1 is you were out of there by midnight or whatever the time is.
But on the same day, the buyer, Gerald Wen, hired 343 of those employees.
Doesn't require that. Just says a permanent or temporary shutdown of an employment site. Your employment site was permanently shut down.
I would disagree because the employment site I go back to is the physical location.
That's right.
That continued to operate
doesn't
through
say
July
that.
1.
Doesn't say that. It says employment site. It doesn't say a temporary shutdown of the facilities. It says at an employment site. It's exact words of the statute. You did not have an employment site.
We did not have an employment site in Hawkins as of July 2.
That's right.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And permanently, you are out of there. You have permanently shut down your employment site.
But not before making sure that the buyer would continue that employment site.
Well, but the statute doesn't require that.
It doesn't, Your Honor, which is why I said initially I'm proud of our efforts. We wanted to make sure that Hawkins would continue to manufacture Norco windows, and it does.
Well, the argument is you get A for effort, but F because you didn't comply with the statute. I'm being facetious, but that, in essence, is really the guts of this argument. You tried to do a very good job to protect the employees. In fact, you got 76% of them protected. But you still don't have an employment site. And if you look at the very words of this statute, textually, you don't have an employment site. What you're trying to do is say it means production is shut down. It doesn't say anything about production there.
Your Honor, I guess I understand your point. I would disagree. I believe that the employment site continued in the operations, and that's TJ International's position. But I certainly respect your opinion.
Counsel, just as a follow-up on that, you offer Webster's definition of site. And
yes. Yes.
A site is a site is a site.
Right.
Okay. But the phrase is employment site. And it seems to me what the Chief is suggesting is that employment site, not focusing on the word site, but focusing on the word employment. Employment means, obviously, you've got an employer and employee for purposes of employment. Now, if you look at the term employment site from the perspective of the employee, you mean where they working? Were they working at this location?
Yes.
If you look at the term employment site from the perspective of the employer, it means does the employer still conduct employment at the site? So although the word site may be very clear, a la Webster, employment site can have different meanings depending on from what perspective of this employment arrangement you have. The employee, which means I'm here working at this physical location, or the employer, which means I have an employment opportunity available at this location. Do you disagree with that?
I would agree that there's a distinction that can be made there, Your Honor. And I would go back to the purpose behind the law, which was to make sure that in situations where there was going to be a stop in operations, people would lose their jobs, they couldn't continue work.
Where do you get that purpose?
Well, I look at it sort of implicitly. If you look at the distinction between the business closing and the mass layoff, it's interesting to me that the legislature used a smaller threshold for business closing than it did mass layoff. And I think it did because of the obvious fact that if you have a physical shutdown of an employment site, of a facility, where that product is no longer manufactured, then you've got a situation where those jobs are lost and gone forever.
The reason I ask the question is, if we have some ambiguity, depending on what angle you're coming from, whether the employment site is perceived from the employer or the employment site is perceived from the employee, then you get to the normal tools of statutory interpretation, and you started to advance the intent of the legislation. In the prior exchange with your co-counsel, there was suggestion concerning legislative intent and reliance on WARN, the federal legislation.
Yes.
But it seems to me I've got a problem with that, and that is that WARN, as I understand it, is only to be an interpretive aid in the regulation. Is that your understanding of the limitation of the effect of WARN?
Well, Your Honor, the regulations certainly talk about the fact that WARN should be used as a guideline and that to the extent possible the state law should be interpreted consistent with the federal law, but that also talks about where the both laws are the same.
Maybe I'm wrong here, but look at DWD 279002.
That's what I'm on.
And I sense that means, when it says, whenever possible, this chapter will be interpreted in a manner consistent with WARN.
okay? And this chapter, of course, is 279 of the Administrative Regulations. And so I see 279.002 saying the regulations are to be interpreted whenever possible in a manner consistent with WARN. But that's quite a leap to say WARN then offers insight into the legislation of 109.07, unless you can give me some authority for that.
Your Honor, I would agree with you. I point to two things, though. One is that, as Justice Abramson has pointed out, the Act itself provided DW with the authority to do rulemaking, and it did. It enacted this. But the second thing is that if you look at the definition of business closing under 109.07.1b, and you compare it with the definition of plant closing, they use the word plant closing rather than business closing, under the Federal WARN Act, which is Section 2101A2, the definitions are astoundingly similar.
But there is no, as I understand it, no legal authority that you can cite to suggest that the legislation, the statute, had WARN in mind, or it can be used as an legislative intent argument.
Well, I can, Your Honor, to the extent that the definition of business closing was changed at about the same time that WARN was passed, and they tried to put those definitions in sync with each other. Attached to our brief, we talked about the change in the wording in the definition of plant closing, where previously it used to talk about a merger, a disposition, or a liquidation.
Isn't a critical distinction the 6A definition between the two?
Between the Federal Act and the State Act, yes, Your Honor, they are different.
So since that's a critical part of the definition in the Wisconsin statute and not part of the warning,
right?
I don't know where you, if it necessarily is persuasive that WARN is to be relied on for legislative intent. Certainly, reg intent. I have no problem with that.
If they hadn't changed the definition of business closing under the state law, I would agree with you, Your Honor, but they specifically did change the definition to no longer include the terms liquidation, disposition, or merger, and they brought the definition more consistent with the definition of plant closing under federal law, and we attached to our brief some of the legislative history that talked about the fact that they wanted the definitions to be similar, which is why they changed them.
Is there any federal case law interpreting the definition of plant closing under WARN? The cases that you cited really went in a different interpretive direction,
I think. Your Honor, I would argue that the case that we cited and Mr. Lynch cited to it too as well did look to the definition of plant closing as well as the separate sales exception in those cases, and they talked about then concluding that an asset purchase like this is not a plant closing under federal law. We argue a business closing under state law. One other question that was asked today was why is it that we, the seller, shouldn't be held responsible for the fact that everyone wasn't hired? And I would say two things about that. One, because we asked the buyer and we made the buyer guarantee that it would hire substantially all. There's been a big distinction about all reasonable efforts versus saying, did you hire all? I think all reasonable efforts is all we could require. In fact, this is employment at will in Wisconsin. You can't force people to become your employees. In fact, 63 never even applied. Quite frankly, the buyer can't be held responsible for that, and I don't think it was fair that the requirement would be that we would force the buyer to say they would hire all when they couldn't guarantee it. The other thing you've asked about is where is this crazy regulation that says that somehow as long as these people are the seller's employees as of the closing date, all of a sudden it becomes the buyer's responsibility. All I can tell you is it was enacted in the regulations. I think there's a good reason for it, because as long as the employees stay employees up to the time of the transaction, at that point the seller no longer has any ability to control what happens to those people. And I think the legislature in this regulation decided that, well, if the seller is the one that now has the opportunity to make those decisions and the buyer is the one that now has the ability to affect those decisions, the buyer should be responsible if it doesn't hire those people.
But can an agency impose liability beyond that which is authorized in the statute in the exercise of its rulemaking authority?
Of course, Your Honor. If the agency enacted a statute, a regulation that was inconsistent with the statute, that would be improper. Our argument is that it's not improper.
Exceeds the liability that is plain on the face of the statute.
Yeah,
can't do that, can it?
I think so, it can't, Your Honor. I think it goes back again to the whole idea of back in 1989, they tried to reconcile these two acts to the best that they could. And I think in the course of that, following that, this regulation was enacted. We said that we should try to make them consistent because it was consistent with the legislative record. And I think that's what they were trying to do. And there's a good reason for it, I think, as I said.
And otherwise, there's a terrific loophole that everybody walks through, which I'm sure the legislature didn't intend.
They went.
This requirement is limited to the very facts of this case, where the termination or layoff takes place on the sale's effective date.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if you don't have something, you guys are gone, and the other guy isn't covered, and the employees are left in the cold, which was not the intent of this statute. So you needed something in the regulations. And this statute clearly does not set forth all the particulars. So if we want to turn the clock back to the 1910s and 20s about no delegating power to an administrative agency, we can say that this is not within it. But otherwise, it seems to be within the general confines of the intent of the legislature to effectuate this kind of purchase.
I would agree, Your Honor. I think that there's a good purpose for it, which is someone has to be responsible. If you're going to hold someone responsible, hold the person responsible that can make that decision, which in this case would be the buyer.
Mr. Duffy, in the definition of business closing in 1B,
yes.
If you focus exclusively on those words, I think one might come to certain conclusions, but suppose you go over to 6A. The sale of part or all of the employer's business, if, doesn't that suggest that in some cases the sale of all or part of an employer's business is going to be part of a business closing?
Your Honor, my light's on, I just want to make sure you want me to answer it. I'd be pleased to. Yes, you're right, it does, Your Honor, and I think that there's a very important point to be made about 6A in the fact that it's not simply redundant and doesn't take away from the definition of business closing. If you look at 6A, what it says is that if the buyer agrees to hire substantially all within 6 months, that gives the seller some exemption. Well, under the definition of business closing, it's a temporary or permanent cessation or shutdown of the employment site. In many cases in these acquisitions, what will happen is the acquiring entity will shut the facility down for a short period of time while it's accepting new applications, analyzing productions, and so forth. And so what I think the legislature wanted to do here is they wanted to make sure that as long as that employment continued within that six month break period and that business closing setting, people are protected. I hope that answers your question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hancock.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to elaborate on an answer given by Mr. Duffy because I think it goes directly to an earlier question by Justice Sykes, which is the apportionment of responsibility under the notice law. If there's to be a business closing and it involves the sale of a business, the seller is required to give 60 days notice to the employees. If they don't, and they want to avail themselves of the exception in 6A, then they're obligated to ensure that that exception is met. In this case, Norco failed in that obligation because they could not force Geldwin, and they did not force Geldwin, to agree in writing to hire substantially all the employees. So Norco failed to do the necessary effort to avail themselves of that exceptions.
So how does that make Geldman liable?
Well, again, Your Honor, if you don't find that there is sufficient statutory authority for the administrative rule, then
you just want somebody else.
Then nobody bears the whole responsibility. I don't want someone. The employees deserve to have notice.
Right.
And if Norco was banking on that exception, then it was their obligation to do whatever was necessary to qualify, and they failed in that regard. If I can briefly discuss the warrant situation, the trial court and the Court of Appeals both found that the warrant analysis does not apply in this case for a very simple reason. Warrant takes a 180-degree different approach to the sale of a business. Sales of businesses under warrant are excluded, and they're excluded because warrant presumes the benign transfer of employees from the buyer to the seller. That's clear on the face of the statute. If you read the Warrant Act, it presumes that employees will be transferred from one employer to another. And the companies in this case have continually characterized this as the benign transfer of the employees. That was not what happened here. That may be the law in California, in Colorado, in Illinois. It is not the law in Wisconsin. Wisconsin requires notice of the sale of a business unless you qualify for the exception. They do not qualify for the exception. This was not a benign transfer of employees. I would refer the court to the letters of June 7th. This is the letter from Norco. I quote, "Because this is a purchase of assets, after the closing of the sale on July 1st, you will no longer be employed by Norco." Goes on, "As a result of your termination from Norco, you have certain rights under your benefit program. These are outlined below." And then it goes on to discuss the continuation of health insurance, retirement plans, vacation. The same day, they received this letter from Jill. "As a potential new operator of the facility, we've not yet made any hiring decisions regarding the hourly positions we will staff or the individuals who will fill those positions. All existing Norco personnel employees will be given the opportunity to apply. Your applications will be considered with all others we've received as we attempt to put together the best possible team to staff our operation." May it please the court, this is a very simple case that turns on one agreed upon fact in the stipulation. Paragraph 10 of the stipulation says that all 459 Norco employees were terminated. That's a stipulated fact. It's also a stipulated fact that the facility continued in operation. It's the state's position that if you read the definition of a business closing as it was drafted by the legislature, clearly there was the closing of an employment site. If the termination of all 459 employees of Norco doesn't qualify as the closing of an employment site, then the statute is meaningless.
But our statute doesn't have that termination language that's contained in the federal law. It seems like you're making an argument that would be more appropriate under the federal law than under our statute.
I'm sorry, my last
one. Our statute turns on the two things that trigger its applicability are a business closing or a mass layoff. You've conceded this is not a mass layoff case. It can only, the duty to notify can only be triggered if this is a business closing. And that doesn't turn on whether there's been a termination or not.
Your Honor, my
yes,
light is on.
Ahead.
It does, Your Honor, to the extent that the definition is in the disjunctive. And it's the closing of an employment site. The state's position is that the termination of everybody that worked for Norco is the closing of an employment site.
You said something...
Not the termination of the production line, that's the other part of the definition.
That's disjunctive.
I'm done. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hancock. Thank you, Mr. Lynch. And thank you, Mr. Duffy. And if you'd all approach the bench, please.